our speaker today is our own Mark Penny from PI and the University of Waterloo, who has been doing some work on COVID-19, probably much more useful than anything the rest of us are doing. So I'll take it away, Mark.
Oh, I believe I'm muted. Sorry, can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Okay, excellent. I had myself muted temporarily, but we're good. Yeah, so it's, I guess, a privilege to restart the mathematical physics seminar, even though there will only be a small amount of physics and possibly less mathematics, depending on how you count it, for this. But yeah, it's fun to talk about it. I've presented this at a few different places, but never to an actual physics or mathematics audience, so that's fun. Yeah, so I'm going to tell you about percolation theory and exposure-based vaccination strategies. These are results from a paper that you can find on MedArchive, which is like the medical sciences archive. They have a much more involved numbering system, but that's it. And surely if you search my name, it's the only paper I have written that's on MedArchive. And this is joint research with a fairly big team. I'll especially highlight Yiyet Yargic, who's a postdoc at PI, who we've worked really closely with. Lee Smullen, who doesn't need an introduction, was also involved on the project. And we also brought in three, we'll say, infectious disease experts. Ed is a researcher at Sanofi Pasteur, which is a big French multinational pharmaceutical company with an office in Toronto. Madhur Anand and Chris Bao are, they have a fairly wide range of expertise, but they focus on modeling systems where there's interaction between like human behavior and biological systems. So that includes infectious diseases, ecology, natural resource management, that sort of thing. So it's been fun to work with some people who have a very different expertise base than I do. And it's led to some interesting research, I think. So one of the things that I started thinking about when I was thinking about infectious diseases was how human contact patterns are like the medium through which infectious diseases spread. And they're quite complicated, as you can conceivably imagine. So I'm showing here some sort of summaries of statistics that were collected in something called the Polymod survey, which is in the infectious disease community quite a famous study. It was carried out, I think, in around 2007, might be wrong with the exact year, but they had something like 7,000 people keep a diary of their contacts for a full day. So they recorded, every time they had contact with a person and answered a number of questions about that contact. On the left-hand panel here, you see some of the results of how many contacts they had. So in the top left panel is the distribution of daily contacts for all respondents. And then we also show it decomposed by age bracketing. So like young people, working aged people, and senior or retirement age people. And one of the things that's important to notice is there's a lot of heterogeneity. I mean, this distribution has quite a wide support. It shows some sort of scale-free or at least multiple scale behavior where you have contacts ranging from, peaks around the single digits all the way up to 80 or 90 contacts in a day. And that this heterogeneity, this doesn't prove this fact, but it's not completely explained by sort of demographic facts. Like there's still a lot of heterogeneity even within age brackets or within genders or within different demographic facts you could imagine. They don't fully explain the differences in daily contact numbers. It's also interesting in that there's quite a variety in how long contacts last. So they asked people how long the contact they've recorded was and how often they see that person. And you see here in this first panel that there was only five possible answers in the survey, but there's quite a range of durations from, very, very short contacts up to ones that are greater than 4 hours, and that there's a correlation between how frequently the contacts are made and how long they last. So daily contacts skew longer, whereas infrequent contacts skew shorter. So that tells us there's some really interesting heterogeneities here, because essentially over a typical infectious period, you'll accumulate a very long amount of contact with your regular contacts and then have a large number of shorter contacts with people you see less frequently. And the reason this is important is that the higher exposure you have to other people, not just in terms of the number of contacts, but also how long you spend in contact with them, leads to an increased risk of being infected by whatever disease we're talking about, and also spreading that disease to others. So it sort of plays two roles in that you have an uneven risk of both to harm to yourself and harm to others. And in the context we were thinking about, we came to think about heterogeneity as actually a resource rather than something that could be seen as negative. You know, when we think of these kinds of heterogeneities, words like super spreaders come up. But really, when you're trying to design public health interventions, you can actually exploit this heterogeneity, because those people who have higher exposure are better targets for your public health interventions. And so if you have a limited amount of public health resources to deploy, if you can deploy them in ways which have higher impact, you lead to a greater result for the same amount of public health intervention. And in particular, we considered whether it was possible to prioritize vaccination of high exposure individuals and what kind of impact that would have. This is a very old topic in infectious diseases, and not just infectious diseases, but of course it's known that people who have more exposure are better to vaccinate. The big problem is that how can you actually identify people on an individual basis who have more exposure than other people? It would require, you'd expect that to require like a really high level of population surveillance by like public health authorities, which is something most of us I think would consider quite unpalatable on the whole. What's exciting is one of the technologies introduced in response to the pandemic actually makes some of these interventions possible that may not have been before. So I imagine many of you are at least familiar with COVID Alert, and I hope many of you have it on your phone. Of course, it's known as an exposure notification app. And as you may or may not know, it was invented or rolled out to assist in contact tracing, the sort of digital contact tracing solution. And apps based on this sort of core technology have seen pretty widespread adoption across the developed world. There's also apps in a lot of countries that maybe operate differently than COVID Alert, but ones that operate almost identically to COVID Alert and are based on the same framework are used across Europe, in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, some parts of the United States. They've been adopted in a lot of places. And the way they work and the way they help in doing contact tracing is that they, using Bluetooth, your app users will do a sort of digital handshake periodically, every 10 to 12 minutes or 10 to 20 minutes. If you're close to another app user, you'll perform a little handshake where you exchange some cryptographic tokens. And the purpose of these tokens is to create an anonymous encounter log that's stored just on your device. It's not a log which is shared. And even if you could access the log, there's very little information you could get from it because everything's kind of encrypted and hashed and it would just look like nonsense. But one of the particular features of the way it preserves anonymity is that you're on your device, if you were able to actually look at the different entries, if you looked at two different entries that it recorded a contact, you couldn't tell if those two contacts came from, say, the same person at two different times or from two distinct people. So there's no way to associate these different tokens to individuals without some outside information. And what that means is that you can't determine how many distinct contacts you have from the encounter log, nor how long any one of those individual contacts lasted. But the length of this encounter log is actually a valuable quantity. It's what we're calling the total exposure time to app users. You should think of the fact that basically this app allows your phone to act as a local sensing device, which measures a specific type of information about your contact with others, which is sort of each entry is like a unit of person contact time. And so this information could actually be leveraged to tailor interventions on an individual level. So we propose that there's a sort of hotspotting approach to prioritizing vaccines, where on a high level, the selection criterion for who is chosen for a sort of priority or in some sense chosen by the app as a good candidate to be vaccinated are based on the number of entries recorded in your encounter log over a given time period. And you can set it up so that decision is made locally on each user's device. So it's basically the thing that a public health authority would need to provide is a recipe or a piece of software which says, based on the number of entries in this contact log, we either select this person for a prioritization or not. But you don't need to share how many entries were in that log or anything about your log. Externally, you would just set the parameters that make the decision process. And what this allows for is individualized selection of people for public health interventions in a way that preserves their data. All public health authorities had to do is lay out the initial parameters for the selection criterion, and then the actual information for which these decisions are based is just purely done locally. The particular proposal we've looked at is one for prioritizing vaccination. And essentially, the software would perform a virtual weighted coin flip each time there's an entry recorded. So every time you have an encounter, your phone flips a digital coin. with some parameter beta that's set, say, externally, and you're selected if you achieve at least one success. You could also increase this to any number of successes over a certain time period, but for simplicity, we just stuck with one. That's the sort of proposal. The proposal is that there's a way that we can select high as well. But the big question is, how can we model the impact that that might have on reducing the spread of an infectious disease? So the approach we took was, and I'll say the way I'm presenting this is that, we start looking from percolation theory and then got onto the project, but we can present it ahistorically here and argue that the sort of natural mathematical language used to model it is percolation theory on contact networks. So what is a contact network? That might be somewhat obvious here, but for the time being, we'll say that a contact network, we're trying to represent the contact patterns of a given population. So the vertices of this network are the individuals in the population you're modeling, and you draw an edge between two individuals if they come into infectious contact. And of course, infectious contact, what that is highly depends on the disease you're talking about. The data we used was for diseases that spread like COVID does or influenza, basically from close proximity physical contacts. An older idea, maybe from the 80s originally, that modeling the spread of an infectious disease through a contact network, you can do that using percolation theory. And how does that work? So in percolation theory, there's a certain parameter that we'll start with called T. And the way we think of this parameter T, it's a probability. And there's for each edge in the network, you have a probability T that it's called occupied and a probability 1 minus T that it's unoccupied. And what percolation theory does is it studies the statistical properties of the subgraphs generated in this way. So of course, each edge is kept or not kept with a certain probability. And percolation theory is, I guess, a broad toolkit which can allow you to understand the structure of these occupied subgraphs. In the context of infectious diseases, an edge is occupied, we take to mean that the disease successfully transmitted along that edge. So this probability T is thought of as a transmission probability. So it's the probability that the disease flowed through that infectious contact. And one of the sort of interpretations of a common thing that you study in percolation theory is, what are the connected components of the occupied subgraphs? Well, these correspond to outbreaks of the disease. And I guess if anyone's heard anything about percolation theory, they know that there's a famous phase transition in most percolation theory frameworks. So there's some critical transmission probability where below it, typical size of these connected components is very small relative to the size of the whole graph. But above TC, you have an emergence of what's called the giant component, which is essentially a connected component, which is of the same order of magnitude as the number of vertices in the graph. That is most true if you take a kind of thermodynamic limit where you let the number of edges go to infinity. And then there really is essentially the size of a cluster is zero, or it's a fraction of the total number of vertices in the thermodynamic limit. And epidemiologically, that's the difference between, if you have a disease which is not very transmissive, you'll only ever see small isolated outbreaks, which don't really take off. Whereas if the transmission probability becomes adequately large, you have the potential for an epidemic, in which case a meaningful fraction of your population. Percolation theory is a very vast topic. And I think a lot of the results that are often discussed or used in physics really rely on the fact that the graphs you're considering are planar, typically two-dimensional, but that's not always the case. But in any case, the type of networks that you talk about for human contact patterns are very different than the type of lattices that you typically see in statistical physics. So you might expect that the techniques are different. And so Newman developed an interesting formalism, which works well for infectious diseases on contact networks. And before jumping right into it, I wanted to take a moment to think about, you know, one thing which is, I guess, different about doing infectious disease adjacent research as opposed to doing something like topological quantum field theories or whatever, is anytime I introduce something into the model, I should be able to specify that thing using empirical data to some extent. It doesn't have to be great, but I should have an idea of, like, if there's a factor that I'm including in my model, how in the world can I actually set those parameter values, at least in a real thing, something in the real world that like measure it. The sort of most high quality data is small scale data where they, for example, go into like a school or a workplace or some other closed environment and have all the people in that environment wear a device which measures their contacts. That could be, you know, they used to do it using like necklaces that had RFID receivers on it. You can also install apps on people's phones which use Bluetooth to do it. But in any case, they're very, very high resolution, but low scale. They cover a very enclosed setting. On the sort of opposite extreme, if you're trying to measure whole populations, like a city or a province or a country, then if you want sort of very large scale statistics, usually the best data available comes from things like contact diary surveys, like this Polymod one I mentioned. And by their nature, they only measure what I'll call local information, which is basically something that you can measure just by sampling a vertex and asking about their neighborhood. So that can involve things like, you know, you can ask a person how many contacts they have. You know, the type of things I showed from the Polymod survey are good types of questions. But measuring something like clustering or higher order graph structure, like, you know, what's a vertices in between this measure? That's not something you can do with a survey. But there are things you can measure with a survey. And Newman's formalism is essentially well adapted to the type of variables that you can measure in large scale contact surveys. Exactly. Well, so I should say for Newman's formalism only incorporates the number of contacts and nothing to do with duration. So he models the underlying, he assumes that the underlying contact network in a population is what's called a random graph, which has a specified degree distribution. By that, we mean pk represents the fraction of vertices in the network of degree k. And by a random graph, you can get into it more, but the sort of key property that matters for this talk is that if you pick a random vertex and you ask that vertex, or you try to compute what's the probability that a neighbor of that vertex, so an edge, another vertex they're connected to, what's the probability that they have degree k? So what's the probability that a neighbor or a contact of a random individual has degree k? Well, it's proportional to k times the prevalence of degree k vertices in the network. And this basically says something like the way your network is constructed is for each vertex, you sample their degree from the group degree distribution, and then you join at the edges randomly. So in essence, yeah, that's the random graph structure. We can talk about it a little more if people have questions. But they also assume a few other things. So one of them is that the graph is locally tree-like, which means the neighborhood of every vertex is a tree. Or in other words, if you have a contact with two individuals, they never have a contact between them as well. That's equivalent to saying that there's no local clustering. This is obviously very unrealistic. Human contact patterns are very clustered. In fact, that's one common feature of them. However, getting large-scale measurements of what clustering looks like is harder because you can try to think of yourself, how would you measure clustering through a contact survey? It's possible, but it requires multiple follow-up interviews. And they also take a large vertex limit, which isn't so important, but essentially you assume that there's an infinite number of vertices. Once you make these assumptions, essentially the main variable or object which describes your random graph is of course just its degree distribution. And it's very handy to work with actually the probability generating function for the degree distribution. So this is just a power series whose coefficients are pk, the probabilities of having, or the fraction of vertices which have degree k. So one of the things that this formalism allows you to do is to derive the basic reproduction number of the network. So the basic reproduction number, it's probably a thing you've all heard about now because we've been living through a pandemic for a year. And it's defined as the expected number of secondary cases that arise from an infected individual. Obviously, this depends on the transmissibility of the disease. That's why I put a T here. It also depends on the underlying network. If we try to sort of reframe how we calculate this in a percolation theory language, then an infected individual corresponds to a vertex one at the end of an occupied edge. Maybe another way to phrase that is it's a vertex one of whose incident edges is occupied. And a secondary case or the number of secondary cases. So if you have an infected vertex, it's the number occupied edges on that vertex or the number of occupied edges minus one. And this minus one comes from the fact that one of the edges that is occupied around you was the one that infected you. So it shouldn't count as a secondary case. And so there's a theorem that Neumann proves, which is that you can actually compute this basic reproduction number, and it's T times this thing. And this mu here is, of course, the average degree, and sigma is the standard deviation of the degree distribution. So maybe naively, you might have thought it would be something like T times mu, because that seems like, okay, this is the average number of contacts, and then T, a fraction T of those contacts will be become infected. But that's not exactly true, because the expectation value here is over infected individuals, and the degree distribution of infected individuals is different than the degree distribution of the network, because people with high degree are more likely to be infected. And the sort of collection effect of that is that there's a correction parameter on this mean, and it's corrected by the coefficient of variation of the distribution. So the larger the relative standard deviation is compared to the mean, the bigger this correction factor is. And this minus one factor is this factor. That's not a very deep thing. I can quickly sketch a proof because we'll use something like it later. And the basic idea is what you want to understand is what is the distribution of secondary cases, because we're trying to compute its average. So we should have a sense of what the distribution is. And the claim, which follows from the model assumptions that Neumann has put in, is that the probability generating function of this, which of course has an X variable as just part of the generating function, and it depends on T, takes a very particular form where essentially we differentiate the original generating function, evaluate it at some particular affine transformation of the dummy coordinate, and you divide by mu. And it's a good, we can try to understand why this particular formula. So if we take T equals one, which is I guess an extreme case, then this generating function, you can actually easily work out the coefficients, and the coefficient of the k minus one power is k times pk over mu. And if you recall, in a random graph, this value pk pk over mu is exactly the probability of a random neighbor having degree k. There should be an equality right here, but unfortunately I missed it in my tech. What this then is saying to you is that this, the distribution that this is describing, is actually the distribution of degrees of your neighbor minus one. So it's the, if you follow to a random neighbor in the network, this is the distribution of degrees, but you subtract one, and that's because of this factor here. And if you take T to be not one, then what you're doing is just taking into account, okay, we have a distribution of how many neighbors, or how many contacts our neighbors have, but we for a T to figure out what fraction of those neighbors will become infected. And R0 is just the expectation value of this distribution. And one of the things about probability generating functions is the mean of the distribution is just the first derivative of the function evaluated at one. And so you get a form which looks like this. It's T times the second derivative of the probability generating function over the first derivative. And again, derivatives of probability generating functions, especially evaluated at one, can be written in terms of moments of the distribution. And when you work that out, you get this. And really the fact that there's a second derivative here is why a second moment appears. So in any case, the sort of key piece is about identifying what this distribution of secondary cases is. And the fact that it takes this closed form follows from the simplifying assumptions about the network structure I made in the previous slide. One of the things which is important for modeling these types of apps, as I talked about, is the fact that they have this intermixing of distinct contacts and duration of contacts. And currently Neumann's formalism doesn't talk about duration at all. You really is just, it's essentially a model where you assume duration doesn't impact the spread of disease, but of course it does. And we know if we're going to model anything related to COVID alert, we have to. And so let's see what we have to do to incorporate COVID alert things. And the basic idea is we work with weighted networks. So in a weighted graph, this is maybe a definition everyone is familiar with, but you essentially attach a label to each edge of the graph. We call that a weight. And the sort of important thing about these weights is that they modify the transmissibility. So essentially we assume that there's some other factors which influence transmissibility. So not all contacts are equivalent. They may have different probabilities of transmitting, and the different factors are labeled by weights. In what we primarily do, we'll be talking about weight being a duration of contact, but it really could be anything. I mean, you can imagine any factor which influences disease transmission, a weight could represent that. The local information in a weighted network is captured by what we're calling the generalized degree. This may exist elsewhere in the literature, but we didn't see a good terminology. And this is now a tuple where we list the, we assume for simplicity's sake that there are finitely many distinct weights and we order them. And then this generalized degree is a tuple which says KW is how many contacts of weight W does that vertex have? So for example, in this little picture, K1 is 3, K2 is 1, say K5, since there's no 5, is 0, and so on. And that's the local information in a weighted network. So of course, it incorporates both the number of contacts and the weighting of each of the contacts. And the thing which replaces the G naught, the generating function, is now a multivariable generating function where we have a variable YW for each weight. And the generating function, of course, has as many variables as weights. And the coefficients, the Q sub K, represent what fraction of vertices in that network have generalized degree K. So it's a very mild generalization. And we can then again prove what the basic reproduction number of a weighted network is. And of course, it depends on this collection of transmissibility. So a bold T is a sequence of T's, one for each weight. And this formula maybe looks a little messy, but the sort of key ingredients here is the math blackboard E thing here is an expectation over the vertices in the network. So there's a few ways to say that. One is you sum over the vertices in the network, or the other way is that it's an expectation taken against the measure, which is the degree distribution. And then, of course, since this is an expectation value over vertices, the random variable that we're taking the expectation value of should be a function which assigns a number to every vertex. And the way it does that is the sum over i's mean sum over the edges which are adjacent to that vertex. And then of course, T sub wi is the transmissibility for the weight of the ith edge adjacent on that vertex. So well, you know, this sum I T wi is basically just sum the transmissibilities on all the edges that are incident on that vertex. And this looks a bit like a second moment type formula, which maybe isn't shocking. But in essence, this involves summing over both the numerator and the denominator involves summing over all vertices and also summing over the edges adjacent to them. So you're really summing over all edges in the graph. This is computationally quite easy to do, but let's see how that formula might come about. Well, the proof structure is identical. There really isn't a huge amount of innovation in this. The key thing is you need to identify what is this distribution of secondary cases. And it turns out that the generating function describing it should be what, I mean, it's a one-dimensional generating function because this is a distribution over one variable, the variable being how many secondary cases. It's a one-dimensional thing. So the generating function should depend on one variable, which is x here. But you notice that it involves this differential operator, nabla t. So nabla t is a first order differential operator, which is essentially an inner product with the gradient and the weight or the transmission vector, if you want. And that turns out to be what the distribution of secondary cases is. All the work in this theorem is actually proving this, but I won't go into that too deeply. What you should notice is this looks very much like the original case. And what we find is that since R0 is the expectation value of this distribution, you basically take the first derivative with respect to x and set it to 1. And that turns out to be the same as basically applying this t differential operator twice on top and once on the bottom. And you should compare this to the formula we found in the case where we didn't have weightings. Or you could say the case where all weighting, there's only one weighting as an equivalent thing. And what you see is, of course, there's a second differential operator on top, a first order differential operator on bottom, and an overall factor of t. And essentially what happens here is if you assume there's only one weight, then you get a t squared on top from the first operator and a t on the bottom, which cancel, and then you're just taking the second derivative. So it structurally looks quite similar. But just as before, you could imagine if you actually had to program something in a computer to compute this, it would be horrible because it's a differential operator. It's, you know, a polynomial in many variables, possibly even a power series. There's, you know, it's complicated. The nice thing about this is that it's very easy to compute, even if it looks slightly inelegant, whereas this form is good for deriving results, but you can't actually plug this into a computer and calculate it very efficiently. So in the particular case when the weights represent contact duration, which is what we care about, we that basically just amounts to a certain form of what weights are allowed and what is TW. So in that case, the weights represent a number of time steps in contact. And we assume that for each time step, there's a per unit time transmissibility T. And that leads to a form for TW, which is the sort of obvious thing. It's 1 minus 1 minus T to the W. That's basically the what's the probability of having one success on W Bernoulli trials, which have parameter T. The interesting thing is that, or the reason why we wanted to think of weights this way, is that the total exposure time, which is what COVID alert measures, is the weighted degree in this network. That's maybe an obvious statement, but that's what it is. It's the sum of the weights around the all. If you pick a vertex and you sum around the weights that are incident on it, that's the weighted degree. And the total exposure time is that under this interpretation of the weights. There's a nice little result here, which isn't necessarily that useful, but I feel like it at least gives some intuition. You can linearize this TW if you assume that you can, as long as you make a small t approximation, then you can linearize TW to be, rather than this form, it's just W times T. And in that case, the formula for R naught on the previous slide simplifies quite a lot, and it looks quite similar to the previous one that Newman had derived, except now the role played by T is the per unit time transmissibility, not the overall transmissibility. And rather than having the mean and standard deviation of the degree distribution, it's of the weighted degree distribution. And another interesting fact is that the one here is actually replaced by an interesting number, which is the second moment. And it's not like, it's not the standard deviation, it's the raw moment. So the raw second moment of the duration distribution. So the distribution of durations across the edges appears here, which is maybe somewhat interesting, but it's not that exciting. Maybe the important takeaway, other than the fact that this maybe renders the previous equation a little more intelligible and shows that it's not so meaningfully different than the Newman results, it does show that at least, I mean, we put it into the formalism, but what it shows is that our formalism captures the fact that COVID alert measures something which is epidemiologically significant, because what COVID alert measures is samples from the degree distribution or weighted degree distribution. It's exactly what the sensing device, which is COVID alert, can do. And we see that these variables directly play into the how the disease spreads, at least in our model. So this gives you an idea of the sort of epidemiological side of weighted percolation theory. We obviously want to talk about interventions which are vaccine associated. I mean, we're talking about vaccinating people, so we should also incorporate vaccination into this. So the idea is that we model vaccination as a stochastic process, which removes vertices from the network. So the sort of underlying idea is that once a person has been vaccinated, we assume that the vaccines are perfectly efficacious, but we can also incorporate any efficacy factor we need to. It's just not that important at the moment. But the idea is that a vaccine takes a vertex and removes it from the network. And we assume that the process which controls whether a vertex is removed or not, it depends just on that vertex's generalized degree. So we don't target other factors. You know, obviously, for example, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout targets things like age, occupation. We're only talking about the contact pattern thing. So we assume that we have a vaccination scheme which can select people based on their weighted degree. So they're not just their, you know, the full weighted degree. So the information about their contacts and the weights on each of their contacts. And I should say that this stuff applies in the general context of weights and not just duration weights. The variable we're interested in looking at is if you imagine you have an original network, and we saw that the rate in which the disease spreads through the network is really about the statistical properties of the network. So the way we're going to analyze vaccination is we say, okay, vaccines remove some vertices from the network. And what we're left with is a residual network of individuals who are still susceptible to disease. We can now ask, how well does the disease spread on this residual network? And the post-vaccination reproduction number will be a random variable because the vaccination is itself a random variable. And we can actually compute the expectation value of this post-vaccination reproduction number. The formula looks messy, I apologize, but it is what it is. But there's a few things we can take from it. The first thing you should notice is that it looks quite similar to the formula I had, I guess, two slides back for the expectation value or for the reproduction number. So we have these terms in between these curly braces. We have a term from the top. If we ignore for a moment the tildes on the t's, that's what was on the in the numerator of the previous theorem, and the denominator is also here. But both of these expectation values have a factor in the front here of 1 minus v to the k. So that's to account for the fact that some vertices are directly removed from the network. That's what this external factor here is. The 1 minus v to the k is what fraction of degree generalized degree k vertices still remain in the network. That's this. The t's are now modified because each one of the contacts, in the original network, some of your u may still be susceptible, but some of your neighbors might have been vaccinated. So you basically readjust this T, so the probability of an infection, to also account for the probability that your neighbor along that edge was not vaccinated. So they have to still be there to have any chance of infecting you. And you can actually compute this factor explicitly, even though the formula maybe isn't super informative, but it's an explicit factor. So essentially, in this theorem, you need to account for vertices directly being removed and then contacts of vertices being removed. All of that's to say is there is also a nice formula, which is quite intelligible and computed in a very similar way to the previous things. One of the things that we wanted to look at was not just being able to assess how well a vaccine strategy does at reducing the rate of spread of a disease. We also wanted to understand, we were thinking obviously in the context of COVID-19, where we have a very constrained supply of vaccines, though thankfully compared to when we wrote this paper in December, they're less constrained than they were in December and January. But essentially, if you have a limited vaccine supply, well, irrespective of whether you have one or not, any vaccination strategy leads to a certain vaccine coverage, which is what fraction of people have received the vaccine. And in our model, in the network model, that's the same as what fraction of vertices were removed from the network. And to compare strategies, what we care about is not just how much does it decrease the reproduction number, but we care about how many vaccines it took to do that. Because of course, there's one really great strategy, which is vaccinate everyone. And that perfectly suppresses any disease if you have a perfectly efficacious vaccine, but that's not a very useful thing to know because you know you can always vaccinate everyone. So what we want to compare is not just how much it reduces the spread of the disease, but also how many vaccines it took to do that. And to that end, we introduced a measure of efficiency of a vaccine allocation strategy, which takes these into account. It is basically the percentage reduction in reproduction number divided by the percentage of population vaccinated. So in essence, it takes into account how many vaccines it took to achieve a certain reduction. And what's really cool about this measure, and this measure came from Yeet, and we thought it was really cool, and we're surprised we haven't really seen it in other parts of the literature, but if you take the uniform strategy, so the uniform strategy is where V of K is independent of K, and you can think of that as at least a proxy for traditional approaches to allocating vaccines, because it doesn't take into account anything to do with contact patterns. In that case, the expected efficiency of the uniform strategy is 1, which makes it very easy to understand what this efficiency means. When your efficiency is bigger than 1, you're doing better than if you distributed vaccines blindly. If your efficiency is less than 1, whatever you are trying to do with your strategy is not doing as good a job of reducing the vaccine as if you hadn't strategized at all, or reducing the disease spread as if you hadn't strategized at all. So it gives a nice interpretation for this expectation. And of course, it's again a random variable, not a big deal. So the particular strategy we want to model, of course, we just set up the framework to do a fairly general vaccine strategy, which targets generalized degree. The particular one we care about is what I talked about at the beginning, the one which can be implemented on COVID-19 contact tracing apps. And there's some internal beta parameter, and you're selected if you have success on at least 1 coin flip. And of course, standard facts about weighted coin flips, if you have K trials, then your probability of success is 1 minus 1 minus b to the k. That's not, in the case of this COVID alert thing, we want to take into account that not everyone in the population uses the app. So we have to ascribe some subpopulation, which are app users, and we assume that they represent a fraction u of the population. And we make some particular assumptions that, like, for example, the contact statistics of app users are the same as the general population, and also that there's no preferential attachment between app users. So if I'm an app user, the probability that my friend is an app user is no different than if I wasn't. And in the end, what you find is that the probability of being selected or being vaccinated according to this scheme depends on the internal parameter of the setup beta and the fraction of the population which use the app. There's some global factor in the front, which is basically your probability of being an app user or the probability that a vertex of degree K is an app user. And then this other complicated term basically is trying to take into account how many contacts would you register, given that you only register contacts with other app users. So really, this is just, it's essentially this formula, but taking into account the fact that you don't have contacts with all people in the network, but just other app users. So that's the V that we'll use in our simulations, which I think start on the next page. Yeah, perfect. So what we're plotting here, so in the first slide, we're just looking at the efficiency. And we plot the efficiency relative to the vaccine coverage. I should say that these simulations are based on a sort of a model contact network, which is based on this polymod survey that I showed you at the beginning of the talk. It's a little synthetic in the sense that it's very detailed in terms of the number of contacts, but duration of contact, as we saw, there was only 5 answers, so it's a little coarse. But in any case, that was the sort of underlying contact data we used to construct our model network. If people have more questions, I'm happy to answer them, but let's just look at the results. So we're plotting the efficiency versus how many vaccines were distributed. In this sort of orange color, we have the uniform or yellow color. We have the uniform vaccination strategy. And then we have 4 other hotspotting strategies for different uptake rates, 20, 40, 60, 100. And what's shown in this plot is just the expectation value, so the average result in the simulations. And what's shown down here are the averages along with the 90% confidence broken up so that you can actually see. So the first thing you notice is that the expected efficiency for anything to do with this hotspotting strategy is always bigger than 1. So that's the first piece of evidence, if you want, or justification that selectively targeting high exposure individuals does actually lead to a greater decrease in the spread of the disease for the same number of vaccines distributed. Looking at the ones with the confidence intervals, it's also statistically significant if you want, in that it's always, the confidence intervals are always bounded away from 1. And in fact, if you have enough app uptake, there are even regions where the confidence intervals for the uniform strategy and the hotspotting strategy are disjoint. So it really is definitely better. Whereas down here, there's so much variance that there's at least some portion of overlap. We also confirm that the expected efficiency of the uniform strategy is 1, except for some small network effects down here near 0, but that's not so important. Another interesting piece is that if you haven't been keeping up with this, it makes sense, but one of the criticisms of the usage of these COVID alert and related apps is that they require a fairly high uptick rate to actually be effective because they're trying to do a different task, right? They're trying to actually catch trains of transmission, and that requires a fairly high rate of app usage to be effective. What we see here is that actually doesn't seem to matter in this strategy. We did put in some assumptions which make that more likely. You could actually make assumptions where if you assume, for example, that the, we made assumptions about what the contact patterns of app users are relative to the general population. You could imagine assumptions where like on average app users are like super low contact people, but at least one thing which is, I think the assumption that they're not hugely different statistically is fairly reasonable. And in that case, you find that the uptake rates really don't have a huge impact. The efficacy is still quite high. And actually what's quite interesting is from the perspective of the efficiency, the relevant variable really isn't the total vaccine coverage, but rather it's V over U, which is what fraction of the app users are vaccinated. I mean, we're modeling a scenario where the only people who get vaccines are the ones who are selected by the app. And as it turns out, the only relevant variable here is what fraction of those people do you vaccinate? And truly, each of these 4 curves are rescalings of one another. You can rescale them all. If you divide by the relevant U, they're the same curve. So what we find is the efficacy only depends on what fraction of the app users are vaccinated, which is really interesting. It means even in a setting where you have very, very few app users, it's still valuable to, it would still be valuable to use this kind of strategy. And that's unlike contact tracing, which is an important point. Another point, which is maybe worth saying, is that as you vaccinate a larger fraction of the app users, the efficacy drops. And it actually, once you vaccinate all app users, the efficacy is the same as the uniform strategy. And that's really a consequence of our assumption that app users are not meaningfully different than the whole population. So if you vaccinate all app users, that's the same as vaccinating 20% of the population in a way which doesn't take into account contact patterns. But yeah, it does decrease. And the reason for that is that as you vaccinate more and more of the app users, you've used up all the high contact people. So eventually you're just vaccinating people which aren't meaningfully better than average. This stuff is also backed up by looking at plots for the post-vaccination reproduction number. So again, the top here is the expected values and the bottom include confidence intervals. And we can see across the board that the post-vaccination reproduction number for any of the hotspotting strategies is better than the uniform strategy. And in fact, the uniform strategy is linear, as we expected. It's why the efficiency of the uniform strategy is one. We also see that these curves all have a sort of characteristic convex shape. And that's exactly a reflection of the fact that the efficiency is initially greater than one and decreases to one. And we're kind of seeing here this plateauing effect where after you've vaccinated a certain chunk of the app using population, it becomes much less valuable to keep vaccinating them. In fact, the slope at a certain point, the slope here is less steep than here, which indicates you're actually vaccinating people who are have lower than average contact numbers. Really exciting about this is that obviously the total amount that you can reduce the disease is limited by uptake. Uptake does matter. It does affect how much you can actually reduce the disease, which makes sense. If only 5% of the population is using the vaccine, using the app, there's really a limit in how much disease you can suppress by vaccinating those people. But when there is enough app users so that it's even possible to reach the herd immunity threshold, which is here on the line, it reaches the herd immunity threshold with a lot fewer vaccines, right? Here's the example where 40% of the population uses the app, and it takes, around 18% or something of the population to receive a vaccine according to that scheme, as opposed to 30-odd%. And when you're talking of a population of tens of millions of people, that's a lot of vaccines. And we also see here that the greatest relative difference, probably measured by where the slope is, the greatest relative difference is around 1/3 of the app using population that should be vaccinated, which also kind of matches here, where once you get past 1/3, you start decreasing fairly rapidly. So let's one more slide here. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the herd immunity question. So what we plotted here is what is the herd immunity threshold, including the uncertainty in it, because these vaccination things are stochastic. Black is if you assume the disease initially had a reproduction rate of 1.5. Versus red, which is 2.2. That's just to show the sort of impact of how changing the ambient transmissibility of the disease affects some of these numbers. But we see here in black that compared to the uniform strategy, as long as you have enough app usage, you see pretty meaningful drops in how many vaccines need to be allocated. The same holds true for a more infectious disease, but you need even more app users to even hit the herd immunity threshold. For example, at an R naught of 2.2, having 40% of your population use the app is not adequate to suppress the disease, no matter how many of them you vaccinate. And what I think is the coolest thing about this, this slide, hold on, I have a video in the way, here we go. So if you've, this has even entered, I guess, common discourse, which is given the reproduction rate of the disease you're talking about, there's a very classic formula in infectious diseases, which looks like this formula without the first term. So it's just VH is 1 - 1/R0. So this formula says the herd immunity, the number of people you expect to need to vaccinate to achieve herd immunity is usually estimated as 1 - 1/R0. But that estimate or that formula is derived from the uniform vaccination case. So without this prefactor, this is a formula which determines where these dots should be for the uniform vaccination case relative to what R naught is. What's interesting is for once you know what the efficiency, once you, with this novel efficiency measure, you find that the efficiency actually rescales where the herd immunity threshold should be. And this is the efficiency of your strategy at the herd immunity threshold. So this becomes a, an implicit equation for where the herd immunity threshold is, which you can solve numerically. But in any case, if you know that your the efficiency of your strategy is always bigger than one, that proves that that actually reduces your herd immunity threshold by the corresponding factor of the efficiency at the herd immunity threshold. And in fact, you can use that this implicit formula to derive a curve, which actually kind of fills out this thing if we wanted to. But in general, you can implicitly solve for the herd immunity threshold based on what the underlying network structure and the vaccine strategy you're using and the R-naught for that disease. So that was the last result I wanted to tell you about. I just want to add a few things. One major limitation of anything percolation theory related is that it typically doesn't tell you very much about the temporal dynamics. So what this allowed me to do is to statically analyze the network structure. So there was some original network structure we vaccinated, which removed vertices from the network, and then we could analyze the resulting network structure. But it doesn't tell us much about, like, you know, if we, over the next 5 months, if you vaccinate this many people, this is what the case curves will look like, for example. It's not a thing with percolation theory is equipped to answer for you. And typically to do this, you have to move to models where you do less analytics and more numerics. So these are things like a degree-based mean field approach or an agent-based model. We've been sort of working on building out both a little, though I think we've lost a little interest in the degree-based mean fields and are moving more towards an agent-based model. But in any case, to do temporal dynamics, we have to do more, and that's something we're looking at. I think the approach thing, which is actually a lot more interesting and is maybe worth filling in some anecdotes, but we first released this research in December and we reached out to lots of people to see what they thought of it. And we got a range of answers on how they thought about it. But one of the things which was really important was the thing that we modeled in these slides is a sort of implementation which probably would never happen, in that what we're saying is that we're imagining a vaccine strategy where the only way to get a vaccine is to be selected by an app, and everyone who gets selected goes and gets the vaccine. This is something that even in a major public health emergency, I don't imagine most countries being happy to do, because a person needs to use the app to even have access. It's the sort of thing which seems that it doesn't sort of align with a lot of the principles of like equity and access to healthcare that we typically enshrine in our public institutions. So the thing we modeled is something which is unlikely to be implemented directly. So instead, the approach that we thought was maybe a little more reasonable and implementable is what we'd call a sort of promotional implementation, where the access to vaccines isn't gatekept by the app. The app only serves as a promotional tool. But to model this, you actually had to think about sort of behavioral aspects of vaccine uptake. So for example, what's the ambient level of demand or hesitancy for the vaccine in the population? Or like, how successful is this promotion, this sort of push notification on your phone? How successful is that converting someone who maybe either didn't care to or wasn't going to get the vaccine to getting them? And what I showed you is the sort of extreme case where the population is incredibly vaccine averse, so they don't get the vaccine unless they're pushed by the app to do it, and then they definitely do. So this, what we sort of modeled is the sort of extreme end of that implementation. But what we find is that even sort of naively changing these factors, the qualitative phenomena is still the same, though obviously the efficacy goes down as you decrease these values, because if people weren't vaccine averse, then they're probably just going to go get vaccinated in a way which doesn't matter about their contact patterns. And most likely not everyone who sees the notification is going to go get the vaccine. So that also reduces the efficacy. But in any case, the sort of qualitative things remain the same. And what we're interested in looking at is, and what we're kind of focusing on now is, there's some really good models for the behavioral aspects of vaccine uptake. And we actually want to incorporate those more diligently into the model. So that's where I'll end. Thank you for listening.
Oh, people using the clap emoji. All right. Are there any questions?
So one thing I was kind of wondering about, maybe you kind of addressed this a little bit at the end. So you still see this as sort of an ongoing project where you want to sort of model more how it's going to actually affect the cases?
Yeah, so it is an ongoing project, but I think our scope may have changed a little compared to, you know, we first put this out in December and things change quite quickly now. Mm-hmm. We had been kind of hoping that we would actually, you know, there's a long story here, but we actually tried to get in touch with Google and see if they'd be interested in like mm-hmm. doing it. It's a really simple software change. Like quite literally, mm-hmm. you just need to add a thing, which is do a friggin' Bernoulli trial every time a case is detected. So it's a very simple piece of technology, but it turns out it's hard to reach people at Google, or at least harder than even I thought. But so our attitude now is more like, we're less focused on COVID-19 because at this stage, most of the sort of vaccine rollout things are very well decided. And I think trying to get a voice in on that now is it's sort of too late. So what we're thinking is actually whether there's more long-term potential, both for in general about these exposure notification-based apps, and then in particular about its use for vaccination. So we're actually curious about influenza vaccines. Because it's a vaccine which comes out year to year, uptake is usually much less good than it could be. There's a bunch of reasons to believe that a sort of exposure-based notification like this could actually increase vaccine uptake. Mm-hmm. And even just in the sort of seasonal influenza, which we all take for granted, has a fairly large mortality and healthcare burden associated with it. And almost anything which can meaningfully improve vaccine uptake would be valuable. So we're looking more towards influenza vaccination at the moment as a more long-term potential use of this idea. But less specifically, I think people might not appreciate just how I don't know, kind of amazing this underlying technology is, because it, in a way, I like to think of it as kind of like the establishment of the global positioning system, in that there's a lot of different uses for that location data now, from like navigation to like advertising, all that stuff. Essentially what Google and Apple did when they released this, like almost every Apple and Android device in the world has the functionality to exchange these cryptographic tokens built into its operating system. That's how it was done. So essentially they established a global network for capturing anonymous contact data, which I feel is something that we could really leverage as a basically a public health utility. So my attitude at this point is any research I do is trying to promote the idea that this technology should continue to exist and we should try to incorporate it as a tool in our public health arsenal.
That's interesting. I mean, I will say, you know, I wouldn't be so sure that the sort of COVID-19 strategy, you know, in the long term is set, right? I mean, you know, somehow like, I don't think this is going to be the only vaccination drive we have to do.
Yeah.
Presumably there are going to be boosters. There might be vaccines for variants. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And in which case that it would at least is structurally similar to our goals with the influenza vaccine.
Yeah.
And we're thinking along the lines of whether this could be part of like a health technology suite. We actually filed a provisional patent even about this. We'll see if we end up doing anything with it.
Right? Because presumably we are going to have to get COVID-19 boosters, and you could imagine sort of, right, with the flu, it's like, okay, everybody knows this is an annual thing, but maybe not everybody knows this is an annual thing, but mm-hmm. I could totally see it being a kind of like, okay, you know, you've been having a lot of exposures, maybe it's time to make sure you have your booster for COVID-19 or, you know, mm-hmm. right, for the flu, we're essentially getting an annual booster, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's really, I've started looking in the literature on like what things actually influence people's decisions to take vaccines, because even people who are vaccine favorable, like we're not anti-vaxxers. I mean, I don't get the flu vaccine every year. And I imagine that's true for a lot of people, because it's a combination of like not feeling as if you have much personal risk yourself, or that you don't really pose a risk to other people, weighed against the sort of inconvenience or other, you know, having to actually do it. And a number of the, you know, a lot of research into vaccine uptake point out about how even things like prompting people that, hey, maybe you should get the vaccine is already enough to push, you know, people who may have already positive feelings but aren't going to bother just because. So even if the contact approach isn't, like say, even if notifying people based on their personal risk isn't necessarily public health pages, which describe the risks and benefits, and you know, the exposure-based pumps also successfully target other factors that we know can promote vaccine uptake as well. So there's some synergy happening.
Mark, I have a question. So I think people will be pretty reluctant to issue vaccines based on an app, but people have talked about giving vaccines in like different areas, which where people might have jobs which require them to be more in contact with people. So
yeah, absolutely.
You could imagine saying, I look at people who live in this area and who have the app, and this gives me an estimate of how many contacts people in this area have, which will allow me to prioritize by postcode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
have you thought about that? I mean...
Yeah, so I think, in fact, you know, the vaccine rollout has a lot of the details of how it's distributed are under the hands of local public health units. And there are public health units who've straight up said that they'll be using known risk factors on the level of postcodes to promote uptake initially amongst those populations. Like say, for example, you have a postcode, which, you know, there's a few different factors they've identified as being good predictors of COVID-19 like case burden. And those include things like education, income, household composition, like areas with multiple multi-generation households are ones which typically have worse outbreaks. And so that is, I know like there's definitely Toronto public health units which are actively taking that into account. My attitude with respect to how those ideas interface with the app thing is they don't have to be either or. You can imagine, though this maybe gets into more things like, right now, when you install the app, the only piece of personal information you're asked to share is what province you're in, and that's it. And you don't share any location information. You don't share anything with the central servers other than what province you're in. You can imagine asking, what public health unit are you in? First three digits of your postal code. That's all still much less information than you give to Google all the time when you have location services on, but you might be willing for people to voluntarily say, I'm in this postcode. And then a local public health unit could say, okay, we know we're looking at this postcode because they've already carried a high burden of COVID-19. And so it's a good idea to vaccinate them. Well, you can also flip on the app so that it operates on those people who are in that neighborhood. So it sort of juices up your already existing approach. So you might have some approaches which you know work well to target people based on demographic or regional factors. And then you can improve it even still because within that population, there'll be heterogeneity. And you can do even better by targeting not just that neighborhood, but the most people with the most contacts in that neighborhood. So I see this as something which can already basically take whatever proposal you already had in place for allocating your vaccines and improve it.
Well, I can imagine, I mean, at the moment when vaccines are scarce, I think people will be furious if vaccines were distributed to people who had, you know, like lots of people, a slightly older iPhone won't run this app. My wife's phone doesn't run. So lots of people would be like, I need to buy a new phone to get an app, to get the vaccine.
Yeah. And that's why we say that it was unpalatable. I mean, that was one of the earliest things was like, obviously you can't do it that way. But that's why we like this promotional approach where it doesn't gatekeep access. It just nudges you to say, hey, look, you know, because of the app, we know you have a lot of contacts. Here's the reasons why it'd be a good idea for you to go actively seek out the vaccine. And they seem to play into factors we know influence people's decisions to vaccinate, which is nice.
All right. I'm sorry, I had to turn my camera off. My internet's been really spotty. Anyways, any last questions? If not, then let's thank Mark again.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.